Well, it's great to see everybody here this morning. Do appreciate your presence in our assembly today. Every month this year, we've been looking at questions that you have been providing, things that you've been curious about, maybe questions that you've always had or questions that you've heard from friends or coworkers or people in the community. Some of the questions have really caught me by surprise. I've been pleasantly surprised, in fact, by a lot of the questions, things maybe I had never thought about before that required me to do a little bit more thinking on the subject. Other questions, though, I'm surprised it took so long to get them. Some questions you almost expect as a preacher because they're so common in terms of what we hear from our worldly friends or Bible skeptics that they're questions we really need to be prepared to answer. So today what I would like to talk about in this ongoing series of questions that you have about life, the Bible, and God is, why is God so different in the Old Testament versus the New Testament? Now, it doesn't take a Bible skeptic long to look for the confirming evidence of this preconceived idea. Any Bible skeptic is already looking for that kind of thing, and as he or she is reading through the Bible, they see the love and the mercy of the New Testament in Jesus, so tender and so kind to everybody that he meets. And then they contrast that with what they find in the Old Testament, which is God telling the Israelites to destroy the Amalekites, every man, woman, and child, to drive out the Canaanites before them, to kill Uzzah, just for one minor infraction, just touching the ark to try and steady it before it falls over. And they see a very different presentation, a very different God from Old Testament to New Testament. Now, is this really true? Is there really that big of a difference between the Old and the New Testament presentation of God? And even if there was some difference that we could identify, is there a reason behind it? What would be the point behind God presenting himself or revealing himself in a different way from one testament to the next? So let's start by asking this question. What is really at stake when we're dealing with this topic? Well, the first thing that's at stake is the credibility of the Bible itself. Because if the Bible doesn't appear to offer a coherent and consistent explanation and portrayal of who God is and what God's character is, then it calls into question the entire body of literature that we find. I mean, really, if we're trying to present this idea that it was God who was the handiwork behind everything that's happened in the Bible, from the creation in Genesis to the eventual judgment prophesied at the end of the book, then how can we deal with this supposed difference, this incredible inconsistency from old to new? The second thing that's at stake, though, is God's infallibility. Because let's just say for the sake of argument that the Old Testament and New Testament really do present very different perspectives on God, very different presentations of God's character. Well, then how do we deal with that? Does that mean that God somehow changed from Old Testament to New Testament, that he matured somewhere along the way? Maybe that he cooled off a little bit. I mean, that's happened to people, hasn't it? We've known people who were real fiery in their youth, but as they got older, they kind of mellowed out a bit as they got a little bit older. Is that true of God, though? Was he a really fiery young God in the Old Testament, but by the time the New Testament comes along, he's matured a little bit more, he's changed a little bit more? Again, I think that really calls into question the infallibility of God if God changes from period to period, from age to age, or does it just mean that he's inconsistent or prone to occasional fits of wild divine rage? But the third thing is this: how do we deal with questions in the Bible? Because there are some real interpretive challenges if we don't see a consistent portrayal of God from Old Testament to New Testament. Then how do we really explain his instances of wrath and destruction? How do we reconcile that with extreme mercy that's seen in the New Testament? How can such qualities as love and hate, mercy and justice, wrath and salvation coexist at the same time? This is an absolutely essential question for the Christian. And we must be able to defend the Bible's portrayal of God from beginning to end, from Old Testament to New Testament. I believe that God is an incredibly complex creature. And the reason why I say that God is an incredibly complex creature is because we are incredibly complex creatures. And if we're modeled after God, even on a very small scale, and we believe we are complex creatures, then how much more complex is God? Are any of us one-note beings? Are you the same person, whether you're angry or happy? Are you still the same person when you're in a good mood or a bad mood? Are you still the same person when surrounded by many friends or when you feel betrayed by people around you? Are you still the same you, even as your mood changes? And of course, we know the answer is yes, because we believe that we're complex emotional beings and that we're capable of things that seem disparate at times, that you can be angry and you can be happy. And sometimes, in fact, those emotions kind of intermingle with each other, don't they? I think Ecclesiastes chapter 7 is a great explanation of that, where he talks about how it's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. At one point in Ecclesiastes 7, he says, "While a face might be sad, a heart might be happy." And we look at a verse like that and go, "Well, how?" Because we're complicated. Because we're incredibly complicated. Because you love your children to the point you would die for them, but you find yourself wanting to rip the hair out of your head because of them. Because you love your spouse with all of your heart and you'd give everything for him or her. But at the same time, your spouse is also capable of vexing you more than anybody else that you know. We are complicated and complex beings, and we're modeled after God. So God is an infinitely complex being. All of our emotions are just small versions of His. So if we're capable of both joy and anger, sometimes very close in proximity to each other, then wouldn't God be capable of the same thing on an even greater scale? A couple of things to think about here. This is why we need to have a healthy dose of fear when it comes to God. Because if you've known what it's like to be angry, especially over something that's righteous, where you are justified in your anger somehow, and if you know what it's like to feel joyful, especially again, when it's a joy that's motivated by something that's pure and holy and wholesome, how much bigger are God's emotions then? And how much more perfect are His emotions as well? Because God's anger is never motivated by greed or selfishness or envy. And God's joy is never a superficial, empty kind of joy. His is a pure joy and a pure anger. And we need to fear that. A healthy kind of fear, not to cower in front of God and be afraid of Him at all times, but to have a healthy fear. Here's a great passage, I think, that shows this complex nature of God in Psalm 104. How you can see here in Psalm 104 that these emotions can coexist with God. That God is capable of so many things here. Psalm 104, beginning in verse 31. Notice here again the extremes of emotion that God is capable of displaying. "Let the glory of the Lord endure forever. Let the Lord be glad in His works. He looks at the earth, and it trembles. He touches the mountains, and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. Let my meditation be pleasing to Him. As for me, I shall be glad in the Lord." And that's very happy, isn't it? That God is great, He's merciful, He's powerful. I give Him all this glory and all this praise. But then notice how quickly the gears shift here in verse 35. "Let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Praise the Lord." Now, the writer of Psalm 104 doesn't see any kind of disconnect there. You notice that the writer of this psalm isn't uncomfortable mentioning in the same breath the joy and the praise and the glory of God and the justice and wrath that will be brought upon sinners. With the same breath, the writer will mention both of those things, and he does not see a disconnect between those things. Notice in John 3 and verse 16... In fact, a lot of the context in John chapter 3 kind of plays this out a little bit here. But let's go to John chapter 3 and notice a couple of things here. Now, we know John 3 verse 16. We've memorized it. We've been hearing it as a memory verse since we were little kids. "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God did not send the Son of the world to judge the world, but that the world should be saved through him. So, on the one hand, God is incredibly merciful. But then notice here how quickly, again, notice how quickly he shifts gears here in verse 19. And this is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. Now those are the kind of people that will be judged. You go one page over in your Bible to chapter 5, and notice here, in John chapter 5, beginning in verse 26. For just as the Father has life in himself, even so he gave the Son also to have life in himself. And he gave him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. So he has life in one verse, and he has judgment in the next verse. Life in one verse, judgment in the next verse. Do not marvel at this, verse 28, for an hour is coming in which all who are in the tomb shall hear his voice and shall come forth, those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, and those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. And those two things are not in contradiction with each other. Those two things are not in contradiction with each other. God is a very complex being. And of everybody, anything, any being who has the ability and the right to display these kinds of complex emotions, it is God. It is God. Given God's emotional complexity, I would say his infinite divine emotional complexity, so far beyond what we could possibly comprehend, would it not make sense to see him respond uniquely to different situations? That, I think, is an essential question, isn't it? As we're dealing with this Old Testament versus New Testament God thing, this question, this difficulty, doesn't this question have to come into play? If you are allowed to respond differently to a police officer than to your 7-year-old child, if you are allowed to respond differently on a day where you get a promotion versus a day when you get terminated from your job, if you're allowed to respond differently to different situations given your emotional complexity, then why do we see it as some kind of a problem when God shows different sides of his character given different situations, different circumstances, and different conditions? And notice, I'm not saying God is the one changing. I'm saying we're the ones changing. The circumstance changes. The condition changes. Things change, my friends. Mankind has changed in many ways. Mankind even changed a lot from the time of Abraham to the time of Jesus. Now, we use this term, I say this kind of tongue-in-cheek. You ever use that term? Back in Bible times. You ever say that? Back in Bible times. Are you talking about a period of history that covers several thousand years? You know, when you're going from a time where people were making little bronze and stone tools to a time when the Roman Empire had the most complex empire ever seen in human history, with a postal system and an advanced military and philosophy and an understanding of mathematics and engineering. You're talking about Bible times, right? Bible times cover the period from the very first time mankind put clothes on to the time that the Roman Empire was running the world. Bible times is not one time period. And from Abraham to Jesus, you see incredible changes in the way that mankind interacts with each other, in the way that mankind understands things like math and engineering, science, and the world around him, the way that mankind builds governments and cultures and societies and art and literature. Mankind has changed a lot. Mankind changed a lot even within the narrative of the Bible. So wouldn't you expect God to interact with mankind or reveal himself to mankind in a way that was appropriate from age to age to age? Let's talk about a few specific things like warfare. Skeptics often point to the wars of the Old Testament as evidence of this angry, greedy, capricious, bloodthirsty, tyrant God of the Old Testament, which seems totally irreconcilable with the loving and merciful God of the New Testament. But the Israelites lived in a world that required a degree of brutality, because they lived in a brutal world. The time of the Israelites, especially the time where they were entering the land of Canaan, taking over the land of Canaan and building a small kingdom there, that was an incredibly brutal and backward-thinking time period in human history. They were surrounded by violence and danger that would make any of us squeamish, which is part of the reason why I think the Bible skeptic struggles so much with the Old Testament violence. You know, today we live in an age that's so scrubbed clean that we're uncomfortable with almost anything that's violent or dirty or filthy or gory. You know, we'll eat a hamburger, right? We'll feel comfortable eating a hamburger or a steak because it doesn't look like a cow. But most people today who are comfortable eating hamburgers would not be able to go and see a meatpacking plant. They wouldn't be able to stomach it. We live in an age where we're simply not emotionally capable of looking at violence and gore right in the, well, you know, eyes on the floor in a bucket. We're not capable of confronting that. So it's no surprise then that 21st century Bible skeptics read about wars of the Old Testament and go, and shove it away. It doesn't surprise me. But for the people living in that time period, that was life. That was daily life. And I don't want to get into too much detail, but you look at some of the examples from the Old Testament. I'll give you two here. In Amos 1, verse 13, and 2 Corinthians 8, and verse 12, we learn of the way that the Ammonites and the Amorites conducted their warfare. And without getting into too much detail, one of the things that they did in conducting their warfare was to rip pregnant women out and take babies out. I mean, you think about that, like, How is it that you can survive in an age where that was a common tactic? Where we're going to come into your town, burn your houses down, take half of you as slaves, kill the others, and any pregnant women, we're just going to cut you open and take the babies out. And that was life for them. That was life. Well, that was the way it was. So I'm not surprised then when I read in the Old Testament that God equips the Israelites with certain brutal tactics, not so they can just hurt anybody, destroy anybody, harm anybody, but so that they can simply survive in an incredibly brutal and dark world that surrounded them. The Amalekites were not good people. As much sympathy as the Bible skeptic might have. I always wonder, by the way, when the Bible skeptic points out the Amalekites and how Saul was commanded to kill every single Amalekite and totally eradicate them. I always wonder, you didn't realize the Amalekites offered their children as burnt sacrifices, right? I mean, that the Amalekites took babies and burned them alive to Molech. You get that that's the people you're feeling sorry for, right? And the Philistines were no better. And the Assyrians weren't any better either. The Canaanites were not good people. The Egyptians were not good people. That was the world that Israel lived in. So God equipped Israel with the kind of tools that they needed to survive in that kind of environment. In Deuteronomy chapter 20, this is the explanation that God gives. And I think it's an explanation that should suffice for any logical person, where he tells them in verses 17 and 18, "But you shall utterly destroy them, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they've done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God." That's why he equipped them, and that's why he commanded them to go to war in the way that they did against the people that they did. God instructed Israel to engage in war, but he never instructed them to become warlords. And I think that's a powerful point to remember. He taught them warfare, and he gave them the tools they needed to conduct that warfare. But he never told them to be warlords. It was never about greed. It was never about power. It was never about lust for flesh. It was about glorifying God and creating a civilization amongst a very dark world that might show some semblance of the light of God. That was the purpose and that was the point of it. But I wonder, even with all of that being said, is the God of the Old Testament
really that different from the God of the New Testament? One thing to keep in mind about violence and warfare in the Old Testament is you're looking at over two-thirds of the Bible that covers thousands of years of human history. Whereas the New Testament is the minority of the Bible. It's, you know, that much compared to that much. And it only covers less than a century of history. So if we're just looking at the total number of times that God judges Old Testament versus New Testament, yeah, the body of evidence obviously falls on the Old Testament, but that's only because that's so much more history and so much more bulk of the Bible that you're looking at. So don't let that skew you. Sometimes it's easy to read the Old and New Testament and think, well, there's so little violence in the New Testament, so much violence in the Old Testament, but that would be kind of like saying, I'm going to read a book about the last 10 years of America's history, and then I'm going to read a book about the 200 years before that of America's history, and, well, there's a lot more violence in that 200-year history. Well, of course there was. 200 years of history is going to have more violence than 10 years of history. But that doesn't mean mankind has changed a whole lot in the last 10 years versus the 200 years before that. So God dealt with mankind in an ancient, brutal, backward time as they could understand Him. And when mankind was ready, to receive something better, something new, God revealed it. And I've always liked the way that it's put in Romans 5, verse 6, that at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly, that there was a timing. There was a timing component to all of that. That Jesus didn't come 1,000 years earlier, and He didn't come 1,000 years later. He came exactly when He was supposed to. When mankind was ready to hear the gospel, mankind received the gospel. And there's other passages that talk about that as well. Go to Galatians chapter 4 and verse 1, for example. And in Galatians 4 and verse 1, Paul writes here, "Now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he is owner of everything, but he's under guardians and managers until the date set by the father." There's a timing component to that, right? That you don't put your 5-year-old child in charge of your business. Now, you might leave that business to your child someday when you die, but that doesn't mean you put your 5-year-old child in charge of your business at 5 years old. There's a timing component to it. "So also we," verse 3, "while we were children, were held in bondage under the elemental things of the world. But when the fullness of the time came," when the right time came, when we were ready to receive it, "God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order that He might redeem those who are under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons." There's a timing component to all of this. So if there is some difference between Old and New Testament, it's simply because we changed. Not God so much, but we changed. God is still the same from age to age, even though He might appear very different from Old and New Testament. Here's the example that I want to point out. This is how I think of it, at least. This is what makes sense in my brain. And when my kids are little, I reveal myself to them in a way that's appropriate for their age. When my kids were babies, little babies, I'll coo and goo goo gaga at them and tickle their feet. And now Sterling is 7 years old, and I don't goo and gaga at him, and I don't tickle his feet quite as much anymore. Still a little bit, though. And when Sterling is 17, I won't tickle his feet at all. He'll be stronger and faster than me by the time he's 17. I'm on the decline. Like, this is it for me right now. I'm as strong and fast as I'll ever be compared to him. But didn't your father do the same thing? Didn't he reveal himself, interact with you in a way that was appropriate for your age? Now, if you look at the way a father acts with his little baby, goo goo gaga and tickling his feet and everything, that's very, very, very different than the way that a father interacts with his grown-up 29-year-old son. Their conversations are very different. The level of conversation, the maturity there, how they interact, how often, it's completely different. But if you just took a snapshot and looked at a man with his 18-month-old child, and then took another snapshot of a man with his 29-year-old son, you might say, Those are very different men. I don't see any similarity between them. There's absolutely nothing that connects goo goo gaga with having adult conversations about financial investment. There is no connection between them. Those are clearly two completely different men. Well, we'd say you're crazy. Because a father interacts with his children in a way that's appropriate for their age. Now, that might look very different from age to age, but is he still the same father? Is he still the same man? Am I still me, whether I'm interacting with a little baby or interacting with an adult child of mine? Am I still the same me? So again, even if you concede, which I don't necessarily concede this, but even if you make the concession that the tone of the Old and the New Testament appears to be very different, that still doesn't mean that there's a difference between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. God simply revealed himself differently and interacted with mankind differently from Old to New Testament in a way that was appropriate from age to age. But even an objective look at the Bible will reveal some incredible crossover between Old and New Testament. That's why I say it's not a concession that I'm necessarily willing to make that the tone is really that different. I don't think the Old Testament is that different from the New Testament in terms of how it presents God, in terms of the content of God's character and his personality and how he interacts with man. Of course, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant are very different in their content and their tone, but I'm just saying how God reveals himself from Old to New Testament, I just don't really think it's that different. First of all, when you read in Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 34, about the new covenant, isn't it amazing that you can read something in the Old Testament about the new covenant and see that God was already planning for the new covenant long before it ever came? When you read in Jeremiah 31, "I shall forgive them of their sins and remember them no more," and the fact that that wasn't an accident along the way, the fact that Jesus didn't come along and God said, "Well, I've got to do something different now. I've used all my old material. What am I going to do? Oh, I could try forgiving them and remembering their sins no more." That's a great idea. No, from the very beginning, God was already planning for the new covenant. Jeremiah 31 wasn't news, to God at least. And by the time John the Baptist came preaching a baptism of repentance, that wasn't news either. So the fact that you have so much material in the Old Testament that points forward to the New Testament, so much material that says God was planning for the New Testament, to me, I think is very indicative of the fact that it's the same God from old to new. Psalm 51 is the same way. You know, Psalm 51 might as well have been written by Paul the Apostle. And if you're not familiar with it, it's the Psalm of Forgiveness. After David was caught, and after he paid some penalty for his interaction with Bathsheba, he wrote Psalm 51 as his begging God for forgiveness. It was his prayer of penitence. God, he writes, "Forgive me and I'll be forgiven. Wash me and I'll be clean. I'll be as pure as snow, as white as linen." That's the language of the new covenant, isn't it? And isn't it interesting that David, who would have written that about 1000 BC, that David wrote something that could have been written by Paul the Apostle or John or James or Peter. And he wrote something that we read today, thousands of years later, and it is just as true today, that when God forgives, he really does forgive. And when God washes, he really does wash. Messianic prophecies also reveal that the essence of the New Testament is threaded throughout the Old Testament. But God still judges. You might think the Old Testament is all about that cranky old judging God, but you can read about examples of the New Testament that points out that judgment is not some antiquated Old Testament concept. That there are plenty of passages that indicate that God is, well, in Matthew 23 and 24, God judged Israel or Jerusalem specifically, for example, that he is going to judge the world in Romans 13 and 1 Thessalonians 5. The world will be destroyed with intense heat, Sounds New Testament to me. New Testament writers didn't hesitate to mention Old Testament judgments also, that Paul didn't see some disconnect when he was talking about the Israelites in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, that they received some penalty for the sins that they committed in the wilderness. Paul didn't look at that story and go, and that just seems kind of weird to me. It seems weird that a loving and merciful God would allow so many people to die in the wilderness. They didn't see some disconnect between the loving, merciful God that they knew in the first century and the God who destroyed Korah and his rebellion. Or the God who allowed people to die in the wilderness because of their unbelief. Or the God that commanded them to go and conquer the land of Canaan. Paul didn't see some disconnect between those things. Uzzah and Ananias and Sapphira are very similar stories because they stand out. They stand out because they're exceptional in their nature. We read about Uzzah, and he only crossed just one little line. He just touched the ark to steady it. It was going to fall over. And Ananias and Sapphira, they told one little white lie. And they told that white lie while doing something overall that was pretty good, right? I mean, they were donating money to the church. So that was overall a good thing they were doing, right? So I found it very interesting that people claim that there's some difference between Old and New Testament God, and you have these exceptional examples in Uzzah and Ananias and Sapphira that seem like they play out like the same story. And God still abhors sin. That's not an Old or a New Testament thing. God has always abhorred sin. And the penalty for sin, the spiritual price to pay, is still death. It was death in Genesis chapter 3. It's death in Romans chapter 6. Those concepts aren't disparate. And God sees faith as a virtue. And in Hebrews chapter 11, the writer of Hebrews goes out of his way to point out your faith in the new covenant, your faith as a New Testament person, it's cut from the same stuff as the faith of people from the old covenant. It's made of the same stuff. It's the same material. The same building blocks that allowed Abraham and Moses and David to be faithful people. They're the same building blocks that help you to be faithful. Faithfulness is faithfulness, whether it's Old Testament or New Testament. So I see a lot of crossover between Old Testament and New Testament. Enough crossover, by the way, that I don't see some great big difference. To me, it's an artificial difference. It's a misconception that people look for information and they look for evidence to confirm a misconception. Somebody told them one time that the Old Testament God and the New Testament God are so different. So then they found evidence to support that misconception. To me, it's just confirming something that you want to believe about the Bible. But an objective look at the Bible really does reveal incredible consistency, divine consistency in personality and character traits, in judgments, in power, as well as in love and mercy from one testament to the next. Keep the questions coming. I really have enjoyed this series with you. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, the way to become a Christian is to believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, to be willing to confess that belief before other people, and to put your life of sin behind you, and to be baptized, to be fully immersed in water for the remission of your sins. And if you have not done those things, you're not a Christian. If you've not done those things, you don't have a right relationship with God. It's time to make those things right. Follow the Bible's pattern and become a Christian today. Whatever need you might have, let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.